Okay, so this is definitely one from the crazy ideas department. And I hope nonetheless that it'll make you think. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. This is work that was done with Robert Cameron in Germany. And for a long time now, we've been interested in these so-called strong field dynamos. The first thing I should explain is what I mean by that. Basically, I mean dynamos where U and B are comparable to one another in what you might call alphanic scaled units. So basically, U and B over the square root of mu naught rho are what you're comparing with one another, but scaling, so U and B are the variables. And the idea is that this is happening over a large fraction of the flow domain. And initially, it was sort of very unlikely, or it seemed unlikely to me in about 2000 that such things could actually exist. Because you're used normally with dynamos to the fact that they are very intermittent, they push magnetic field around, the motions push the field into narrow features, which then tend to dominate what happens. And there was, of course, a lot of worry about the fact that you didn't seem able to generate very strong magnetic fields when you did this. So I came into this game very skeptical that such things existed. And Robert was worried by my view and said, oh, well, I think it could happen this way, you see. So we cast around at what was around, what dynamos were around then. And I remembered that there was this dynamo where I'd actually been the PhD examiner for this dynamo. And it was the dynamo of Vasilis Arhontis, where in his PhD he found this dynamo where you had kinetic and magnetic energy densities which were equal everywhere in the flow. And then when you looked even more carefully at his calculation, you could see that actually U and B were almost the same as one another. And that was pretty amazing. To be honest, Robert and me and I didn't really believe it. So we decided we'd do the calculation again. We did it in a slightly different circumstance to what Arhontis had done. He did it for a compressible fluid, and we did it for an incompressible fluid. But basically, all you do is you force a flow with this particular force in the momentum equation. So it's 2 pi periodic, this thing. And what you find when you do this is that in some amazing way, which has absolutely no right to happen, and you still don't really understand why this happens, understanding physically what's going on with this thing is, for me at least, a quite important problem, which we made partial progress with, and that we'd like to make a lot more, is that the velocity settles down to something which has an amplitude which is almost a half sine z, sine x, sine y, and then it's not exactly that. There's a few extra, there's extra Fourier terms in, because you're doing this in a Fourier space, this calculation. There are a few extra terms which are present at the few percent level. But they don't change the basic picture of the flow when you plot it, that you end up with a dynamo, which largely is very laminar, and it's completely steady, and that's what you get. And we published that in 2006, of course. Arhontis fixing his PhD thesis. Well, it means they're approximately equal. And what happens is that as you let the diffusivities tend to zero, they become more and more and more equal. Okay, so you let mu tend, the differences between U and B are of order nu. And you know, we typically did these calculations with nu equals eta. I showed last week some calculations where we changed that a bit. It doesn't make an awful lot of difference, at least for mu and eta close, around one. Mu over eta around one. You can take quarter or four and it looks the same, basically. So what I'm saying is that they become asymptotically equal to one another in the low diffusivity limit, but they don't quite become equal to a half sine z, sine x, sine y, because there are these few percent terms. Anyway, that's published, and I've talked about that a lot in the past. What this led us on to is the following idea, that suppose you can actually manufacture dynamos almost to order if you do the following procedure. Suppose you've got a steady solution to the induction equation. So you can have a dynamo which is a kinematic dynamo, and it's you pick the Reynolds number, the magnetic Reynolds number, to be precisely the critical value. Okay, then what you can do is you can scale that dynamo up into a nonlinear regime by the trick which I've written down there. So you reduce the diffusivity, and you correspondingly reduce the velocity, and you allow any multiplier, scalar multiplier, of the magnetic field that you've had in this critical dynamo. Okay, so you make this new dynamo, which you can actually see, so obviously it's still going to satisfy the induction equation, because the diffusivity and the velocity are both scaled down with epsilon, and this lambda doesn't make any difference in the induction term because it's parallel to the velocity is that bit of the velocity is parallel to B. So that's a perfectly good dynamo solution to the induction equation. And what we're going to do is to take epsilon being small, and then you can say F is, you're going to have to produce some force which is going to make the momentum equation satisfied, but you can actually calculate what that force is and then just say, okay, I'll put that in the momentum equation, and lo and behold, you've got a solution to the full MHD problem. And if you let the diffusivity zero tend to zero, what you get is a dynamo where U and B are parallel to one another, so they're aligned with one another, and in the our Hunter's dynamo, they're actually both plus or minus, you can either have lambda equals one or lambda equals minus one, there's a symmetry between the two states. And that's a good solution, even not for the Hunter's curve. The one thing this argument doesn't say anything about, of course, is the stability. Heaven knows whether the thing that you concoct by this is stable. And of course, the force is fairly arbitrary. It's not arbitrary. It has to be whatever you need to supply. So it's a very ad hoc procedure. It's really cheating in some sense of the word. But on the other hand, kinematic dynamo theorists prescribe a velocity. All we're doing is prescribing a force, and that's typically what people do in dynamic dynamos do anyway. It's just not a natural force. It's not something nice like buoyancy. Friedlander and Vishek actually showed that for the diffusionless case, any U and B which are equal to another are actually solve the momentum and induction equations. And Friedlander and Vishek showed this interesting result that all these solutions, when you do this, are actually neutrally stable. But we don't know what happens when we have some diffusivity in there. Okay, so this gives you a recipe for trying to make nonlinear dynamos. And what you can do is you can take any of your... You can go to the dynamo shop and buy a dynamo, as it were, and you look for what ones are around. So common non-numerical dynamos include Herzenberg, Gibson, Ponomarenko. They were some of the first ones that were done, and you can scale them up according to this recipe. And we did this in this paper for the Gibson three-sphere dynamo, and that works and ends up being actually rather similar to the Arhontis dynamo. In some ways, the way that Gibson three-sphere dynamo works is each one is acting as a rotor for the other two, and when you look at how the Arhontis dynamo works, it's got these heteroclinic orbit structures which are actually acting as rotors for the other heteroclinic orbit structures in the flow. So that's how that gives some insight into how the Arhontis dynamo works. Ponomarenko dynamo, I spent some time, I was just in Chicago, thinking about that, and I wasted a lot of time before I realized that would never produce anything that was very useful as far as the sun went, so I gave up on Ponomarenko. Meanwhile, though, another very common, well-known dynamo is due to Gailetis, who maybe, is he here? Yeah, he's here. Right, okay. So I'm using his dynamo here, and he's not going to enjoy what I'm going to do with it, I think, because of the wacky aspect to it. But anyway, Gailetis' dynamo consists of these two sort of smoke ring-like objects, and the whole velocity field is axisymmetric, and it just consists basically of two rings like that, which have to rotate in opposite centers in order to make a dynamo. But the details of what the rotation is aren't actually very important. All that matters in the answer is an integral which is some weighted average of the velocity and the profile in the ring. So anyway, Gailetis calculated this thing and gave a value for the critical magnetic Reynolds number, in terms of this quantity here, where f is an integral which involves an inverse 3/2 power of a distance, and an inverse cube of a distance. So, and according to Paul Roberts, can be evaluated in terms of hydrogeometric functions. I mean, the exact form isn't really important, but we did use the exact forms when we calculated the magnetic fields in this thing. Now, you have obviously to have a non-axisymmetric magnetic field when you make one of these things. And so the non-axisymmetry is specified by a wave number, and we've taken the wave number m equals 1 for reasons which you'll see in a minute. Okay, so you've got that. Now what I'm going to do is you can generalize this. Okay, so you can make an infinite line of these things. Each separation of each ring is z naught still, and the from its neighbor in the pair, and the separation of each pair is z1. And when you do that, you can work out just by saying that the field induced by all the other rings has to be equal to the field at one ring here. You can work out what the critical magnetic Reynolds number is for that too. And you can actually calculate the magnetic field, which is what I'll show you in a minute. You can calculate the integrals numerically. Or you could use tables and hypergeometric functions if you wanted to. Okay, now what I'm going to do. So what's this got to do with the Sacker climb? Well, this is where the speculation starts. So let's suppose that we take one of these things and we make it into a ring. So a ring of rings, in other words. So you've got a ring of these ring pairs, somewhat like I've drawn there. And obviously, if you did that literally, you'd end up with an infinite number of rings. So you have to assume that asymptotically, when you bend it round into a large torus, the whole row into a large torus like that, that it's still going to work as a dynamo. And I believe that's the case, because these integrals are fairly rapidly converging as you go away from the neighborhood of a local ring. So you bend that round like that. And then what you can do is you can turn this into one of those strong field dynamos, whereby the residue that we've talked about already. Then what you do is you can park this ring in the Sacker climb, okay? Which, as we all know, is a strong shear layer at the base of the sun's convection zone. Now, this is the bit where the helioseismologist's teeth are going to grate, because I should go back and tell you why we're doing this and what the field structure is. Okay, so there's the original Gaelicus rings, here's our ring of rings here, and there's the field that you have along the axis of the row, or in a plane crossing through the axis of the row. And what you remember, the dependence is e to the I phi. So that means that if the field has one sign on the back of that row, it's going to have the opposite sign on the front. Now imagine parking this in the convection zone, in the Sacker climb, and suppose that you have a meridional circulation in the Sacker climb, which has a period of 22 years. Okay? What's that going to do? It's going to take the field at the back, and it's going to bring it to the front. So the field at the back, remember, has one sign, and the field at the front has the opposite sign. And that's going to be true all the way going around this thing, because I constructed it with the symmetry that what's called quadrupole dynamo. There are two parities to the Gaelicus dynamo. You can have the quadrupole or the dipole, and the quadrupole one is the one which always has the field pointing in one direction on the front and the other direction on the back. So you have one of those, and you're going to let it wind and round and round and round in the Sacker climb with a period of 22 years. And what that's going to do is it's going to present a field of opposite sign to the lower boundary condition as a lower boundary condition for convection zone every 11 years. And that's basically it. So that's what I've said at the end there. I'm running out of time, so I better go fairly quickly. So we'll park one of these sets of in the Sacker climb. Of course, they'll get squashed and distorted, and all sorts of things may well happen to them. But nonetheless, assume that the whole idea still keeps working in some sense. And what's going to happen is that this thing gets convected around every 22 years, and so basically it presents an alternate boundary condition to the convection zone every 11 years. So you end up with something like that, which I've tried to draw. So there's my meridional circulation in the Sackett line. This is an old picture, and Steve pointed out it's slightly inconsistent, but there's your meridional circulation in the convection zone, which we think has a velocity of around a meter a second here. Okay, there's the meridional circulation in the Sackett line. In principle, it's possible to scale it up, like I talked about earlier. So you could, if you wanted. We haven't done this in any formal sense. But you can, once you've got one of these dynamos, scale it up. So the ramifications of this are that the surface, now we take over the rest of the solar dynamo story that the people in the convection talk about, lock, stock, and barrel. So we say, okay, you've got this field going round and round, it presents to the lower convection zone, and then magnetic buoyancy is going to get hold of it, and it's going to come up through the surface. It's going to acquire the twist on the way to generate the dipole field that you see. And it's going to basically give you everything that you expect to see in the solar cycle, because you've got this thing going around. So fields of one polarity, if the meridional circulation is towards the equator, fields of one polarity are going to occur first at the higher latitudes, and then they're going to make their way to the equator. So you'll get butterfly diagrams out of this. It actually explains many aspects of the solar cycle. But for the same reason that the theories that we have at the moment explain all the aspects of the solar cycle. But the great advantage of this story, from my point of view, is that the field is down there all the time. It's been going round and round forever. So you don't actually, if you're being literal about it, need to have a fast dynamo in the sun. You can get away with a slow dynamo, which is built up over millions of years. And the point is that this procedure of shedding field, the magnetic buoyancy picks up stitches of field and brings them to the surface, just like everybody's always said they do. But it doesn't destroy the field system, because the field will eventually just reconnect and get back to the bottom, and that will it'll survive the exercise, basically, and it just keeps going round and round and round in there. That's it, really, I think. Well, obviously, you can criticize this from any number of points of view. The crucial thing, I should mention some numbers here. Once you start doing this, it has to be one of these U equals lambda, strong field dynamos. And that means that what's going to limit the field is likely to be the differential rotation in the Sackett line. And we know what that is. That's about plus or minus 50 meters a second. And you can actually use that as a basis for saying what kind of field strength you expect from this. And if you do that argument, you get about one Tesla. Which is about figure. Some people think it's too small, but it's generally speaking the figure in the ballpark that most people think about. The meridional circulation, you might say, doesn't go around that fast. No theoretician believes that believes that the thing goes around in 22 years. But if you actually calculate the velocity that implies, it's about a meter a second. So it's similar to the velocity that people talk about existing in the convection zone above. It's not as ridiculous as it first seems, is what I'm really trying to say about this dynamo. There's the conclusion. The specific model presented here is a thought experiment, and it obviously can't literally be what's happening on the sun. I mean, I gave a version of this talk a few weeks ago, and people said, the Gaelitis rings will get sheared. Sure, they will, according to this picture. But you have to reckon that maybe something, it's not exactly the Gaelitis rings, but it's something that needs to generate a non-axisymmetric structure. It might be forcing from the giant cells above. There are various things that could do it. But the idea is that the Sackett line would have this permanent structure, and the great thing is that this avoids what I've always thought of with the solar cycle as a Herculean task of explaining how the thing manages to regenerate itself in a carbon copy almost every 11 years with such amazing regularity in the whole polarity laws. And if indeed there is something like that down there doing this, then it would help solve that problem. Okay.
Okay. yes, if you take the Arcontis dynamo, and so with PM equal 1, you have U equal B or U equal minus B. And what happens if you change PM slightly? If you increase it slightly or decrease it slightly, how does it change this law?
How does it change? It still does the same thing. It still goes into the U equals B state. But what happens is it depends on how you force it. Because the forcing that we used and our hunters used is proportional to the viscosity. So if you reduce the viscosity, then, keep the viscosity the same and increase the magnetic diffusivity. Then what happens is that there must, I mean, this is an interesting issue actually, which I talked about a couple of weeks ago. But certainly for PM equals a quarter and PM equals 4, you get the same thing, except that there's a change in the energy because you're having to do the total energy because you're doing work against the Lorentz force. I can tell you the rest of the story afterwards. There is an interesting issue there about what happens if you keep increasing the diffusivity.
Okay. Then I'll just next, yeah?
So the forcing that you use here, the sine Z, sine Y, sine X, it has got a global zero helicity, right?
Global zero helicity, yes.
So does this have anything to do with this equipartition? Or is it a precondition required for this U equals B? Or do you obtain equipartition even without this?
I would expect that you can do it without it. I doubt it's crucial, but to be honest, the question hadn't really occurred to me before.
Because there is another paper by Minini, Pouquet, and others who have obtained the same U equals B solution with a zero helicity. But it's a slightly, Taylor Green forcing.
Yes, I know about that calculation.
And both these papers have the similarity that they have zero global helicity, although they have local helicity.
No.
So I wonder if that has got to do with making the advection and stretching of the magnetic field equal in the induction equation, which makes the U equals B solution possible.
Yeah, we have some insight into how it's possible, because what you want to watch, rather than the kinetic helicity, which it's true is, it's zero on average in this in the Arhontis dynamo, but the cross helicity does something very interesting. I didn't really want to spend much time talking about, but the cross helicity, what happens is the calculation starts off after introducing a seed field. It goes into this low-level turbulent state. And meanwhile, all the time, the cross-helicity, which is the alignment between U and B, is growing steadily throughout the calculation. And when you get towards the end of the calculation, it whacks up suddenly, because once the cross-helicity gets to 1, then U and B have to be aligned, and that's when you go into this Arhontis state. But it must be stressed that this is a slow process. All these things which involve growth of cross-helicity and alignment proceed on the diffusive time scale because it's an invariant of ideal MHD.
Let's say you do have some sort of circulation in the Taclocline 22-year period, does that not induce some other circulations deep in the interior that might have some large-scale effect?
Yeah, novices at the Taclocline game, and one of the things is that to do this job properly, you're going to have to make a proper theory of the Taclocline, and you're going to have to properly couple it to the radiative interior. And like I said, this is a sort of simple thought experiment. Our hope is that when you do the job properly, these sorts of things will emerge. And to some extent, there's some evidence, from particularly Matt Browning's calculations, that something similar may actually be emerging. But the answer to your question is I don't really, yes, in principle it might. Steve tells me that the meridional circulation is the same as what's observed deeper down, and therefore the natural driver for this meridional circulation would be the layer above rather than the thermodynamics of the Taclocline itself. But I wouldn't really, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, that's exactly the question I have. I think you have a new Herculean effort of Herculean problem of how do you move a 1 Tesla field with a 1 meter per second flow. It's the kinetic, the magnetic energy is far
predominantly meridional. So So, and the field is predominantly toroidal, so you don't actually, you just carry it around without distortion almost. The only place where this particular model has significant distortions away from the toroidal field is in the immediate neighborhood of the Gyletus rings.
But you still got to move it around against...
But it's perpendicular. I mean, you're not doing any work because the velocity is perpendicular to the magnetic field.
There would be some hoop stresses.
Yeah, there
are
hoop stresses.
Okay, just one more, I think, Yuri, and then we'll have to move on.
There's so many few occasions where frivolity is allowed. We have this unusual business of having Argus Gyletus here. What is your reaction to being multiply replicated and being placed in a tachocline where you're supposed to roll over every 22 years? Have you any comments? Argus doesn't know what to say.
You want to reply?
I do not know what really happens inside sun, and so I am not astronomer, and I cannot comment. Let comment for them who know what really is inside sun.
Thank you very much. Okay. Right, so